this complex topic. The ethical issues at the end of life, or as I like to focus in on what is the real issue, when not to teach, or when caring must be substituted for curing. When cure is not possible, what level of care should be offered? The key issues sum up the topic. First, not to confuse brain death with irreversible coma, as it's now referred to, or the most extreme form of it, PVS, permanent vegetative state. Brain death has become an accepted indicia of death in, I guess, all states, in all countries, all states of the Union, all countries of the world. Mentioned halakhically, it's a perfectly acceptable, if not preferred, method of determining death. I left it in my Gemara. I just got to make you a copy. I have time to employ for that. Give you a copy of my share of that called Shiva on brain death. You can have it here. The notes, see it inside. The latest technique for undoing the past or for perverting the truth is to deny, known as revisionism. You deny the Holocaust ever existed. In the physical world, you deny the Holocaust is here. Organ donations are a concern. The issue of brain death, of course, since vital organs can only be taken from a brain dead individual. We pointed out that there are good reasons not to treat. The key reasons for not treating, of course, the key reason of course, that the quality of life is unacceptable to the individual patient. Not unacceptable to his family, unacceptable to the doctors, unacceptable to society. The triage reason, it's unacceptable to the patient. And if the patient is sentient and can communicate, of course, that's an absolute reason not to prolong any kind of therapy. We exclude from the concept of therapy provision of nutrition and hydration. That is not under consideration. Naturally, a sentient being, he refuses to take any food or water. My share has a very nice tutor in which he analyzes the whole problem and emphasizes coercive force can never be used on another human being. Who is dying and whose quality of life is unacceptable to him. You can cajole him, you can feed with him, and you must continuously offer him to take food, but you cannot tie his hands to the bed, you cannot forcefully do a gastrotomy on him or pass an NG tube down if he refuses. In the absence of his refusal, because he is non-sentient, he is non-competent, cannot communicate, then you have no choice but to go with those other two criteria that we discussed, best interest or substituted judgment, and naturally, under those conditions, we would never withhold water or nutrition from the patient.
The
only parts that we're talking of, conditions were not the chief. We're talking now only of a dying patient. As I mentioned previously, where the diagnosis of, quote, dying patient has been made. Under such conditions, the quality of life, even though we cannot express it, but that involves intractable pain, we have a right to substitute judgment to assume that such a patient cannot bear this kind of existence, and in intractable pain, certainly, there should be nothing done to prolong this patient's life. Of course, nothing done to shorten this patient's life. We cannot hasten death, so we need not prolong life. Here we'll answer your question. The question was posed, what about this ghosting? What is a ghosting? The truth is that a ghosting is what we say it is. And it depends on individual cases. A ghosting is what is known medically as in extremis. A patient, not who is dying, but who is dying. Not dying over the next week or two, he's dying. He's in the process of dying. There is a process that's called ghosting. He is continuously slipping further and further away from life. And the call in the Gemara was always 3 days. The first can be a ghosting for 3 days. If he's going to die within 3 days, he has good physical evidence. These are the kind of patients who would never make it more than 3 days. That would be a ghosting. Nowadays, the ghosting definition has been utterly confused by advancing technology. The advantage that we get from advancing technology is so massive, we don't fully appreciate it, that even in a dying state, medicine can do much for a patient. Press the drugs, one patient dies in 2 days. His blood pressure is dropping, his heart action is slowing down. What's going to happen is what? The oxygenation of the brain will be decreased. It gets decreased long enough for there to be improper oxygenation of the breathing center. So that the ghosting situation hardly arises anymore. The Gemara, however, recognized that ghosting, which the Gemara says also ligavo, as the Rambam records the Lashon of the Shalmi, for it is like a flickering light, flickering flame. If you reach your hand out, you think you're going to improve it, because it's flickering, you put it out. You think you're going to help it, and your name is in your body. So we keep our hands off of those. But some of the Shulchan Aruch said, two cases that the Shulchan Aruch mentioned, Gazir Shalmela, that lump of salt I mentioned to you that was put under the tongue of a dying patient, so that the smothers prolonged his life. If he seems to be comfortable and he's about to keep him breathing, make his features, he was doing better because he put a lump of salt under it. His tongue. Or maybe he was doing better if he hadn't been eating for a while and suffering from electrolyte imbalance, including hyponatremia, and then TRE-MRA, hyponatremia, too little salt, this will kill a patient. If you salt, maybe it actually helps. That's a bad result. You know? You can open his mouth, you can't do that without touching him, and take the lump of salt out from under his tongue, you can't do that without touching him. So it's literally that bone with per bottle. And nowadays, that's the only qualification I would make in ghosting. We have a count of the ghosts which have to be taken away from that time limit of 3 days, but that doesn't mean we should do a lot better than 3 days. So the issue is very simple. The Torvoto or also the benefit. For your benefit, you do a study, you want to know what the blood picture is, and then down to the time when he died. Yeah. Also you know each of the eyes, the mortality first of the patient. If you're going to go ahead and stick a needle in him and give him pressure drugs to raise his blood pressure, and you take a needle in order to provide him with water, certainly as much as Tova, as the Gavir Shalmela taking out
something that clearly could benefit, certainly perfectly mutual to do so. To go ahead and step in for a CAT scan, the very movement of the patient, and we give you some statistics, unbelievable statistics. One from a neonate ward, one from a dying ward. Ward with old people who are dying. It shows that changing the bed in them causes a drop in blood pressure from 110 to as low as 60. If a patient who's debilitated dying and you want to move to one side of the bed, how the nurse is doing it, changing. And that thing also that you change the rhythm halfway at a time, all of that drops the blood pressure. The exact same thing, a beautiful study in Manchester in the neonate intensive care, they show the extent of the baby, the blood pressure drops. And the baby's respirator, so they came up with the new Manchester with their sort of ruling. They used not the term diaper, but nappy. Do not change the nappy. But the baby is lying there in the wet nappy, she's gone and gone. When things are rough, the baby's obviously not doing well, so diaper. The worst is going to happen. So, there's no bad odor. Babies don't have bad odor to their excrement. That's not true, and they don't have any bacteria that causes the bad odor. The odor of feces, you know, doesn't do with the food you eat. It has to do with the bacteria in your gut. And the odor that you smell of feces, if you grow E. coli in any nutrient, raw, and you smell it, has an excellent smell. It's produced by the bacteria, not by you. So we're not a thing that affects the intensive care unit, but that is function. The other point is the risk-benefit ratio. That is, that procedures that have risks involved must be reevaluated in case of a dying patient. Even though they may lead to prolongation of life, the very fact that they have risks involved prevents them from undertaking this protocol and procedure. There's no ethical basis to subject someone to the possibility of immediate dying because you may go ahead and prolong his life. Prolongation of life is an adequate reason for risking life. Unless the prolongation is significant. Now what's significant? When I walk in, I told you, the scientists told us significant in the year. That's the year called time short. A lot of virus for that. If that's the rule we follow, that's very good. If someone who has a hope, if surgery is successful, we can get them to live for more than a year, and you really need to take some risk. But the best thing to do is keep them alive a few more months, then there are a lot of factors coming, one of which I have never discussed with you next year. First, one of course is the simple risk evaluation. That's one thing to be passive, nothing to be active. To not treat him, you know, and could sort of live longer, I'll have to bear that too. But to treat him and kill him on a table, kill him to your dying, is a far greater sin which I'm not willing to take upon myself. That's the very risk them. But there's another factor too, and that's something which really, I should work out a full lecture on that, and that is the concept of certainty, or uncertainty, or prognostication, or prognosis, certainty, coming in any way. How good is your estimate? That's the doctor. I had two shots last night, one after the other, both after midnight. One concerning a patient who is obstructed. A young woman, they're calling from Minneapolis. Mother, a father, dying cancer patient, and obstructed. And the doctor recommended that they unobstructed. He had a colostomy, obstructed one before. And obstructed means what? Let's understand. That's why, you know, that's how you're for people don't know what you're talking about. And what's up with us also? What does obstructed mean? Nothing is going past a certain point. The better thing in this case, above the colostomy, right? That's not functioning. You don't know what a colostomy is.
So what are you going to do?
Make another question. You hire up a bypass person.
Okay.
What are you going to do in that? What will be?
They should have died.
Come on.
That's the devil.
Come on. You only die now. That is useless when you back me up. Filled with the smell of it. So the seed seeds are nothing but food. There's any food but the bacteria there. Growing, the coli is growing in there. And growing on the gut is useless. The solar is pink food. It's swimming in a toilet. That's the gene we have. It's constantly retching bile. It's filling up with a little poison in it. You can't have a man like this. Have them die like this. And they look new aspects. They have to be taking money. It's not a doctor, she does it at home. The doctor says there's a 50-50 chance of surviving the bypass surgery. It's a bypass and intestine. The bypass, the obstruction, so that you can get out of the clock to the end. How good is that to be 50-50? The doctor has 4,000 cases. Another interest like this, 11,000 cases. It's running from 50-50. That's 50-50. It's a good number. To me, there's a good risk, there's a good chance that I pull it off. I call it 50-50 chance. I realize that they were just taking numbers on the basis of some feel of right? Some destiny, what we call it, right? What destiny? No. If you go with it, you have no pleasure. You're mortal. You're fallible. You have nothing else to go with. That must be factored in when you tell me risk-benefit ratios. Well, I think you'll live only 4 months. If I do the surgery again, you'll live 9 months. How good is that in the view? And what if I tell you that I think if you do nothing, you'll live 11 months? As in most of the cases that we've seen, on all cases that I've been involved in, there are hundreds of cases where we've had not to do anything, the patient always lives more than the doctor did. Are you going to pass over? How do you take that into account? That a granddaughter is being married, a granddaughter is giving birth. People factor in will to live and all these things. So there's a fundamental doubt as to how good your ratio estimates are, which also encourages you to keep your concentration hands off. Leave it alone. Like, if you don't know what to do, you don't do it. Two rules in medicine. If you don't know what to do, don't. And the eight broke, don't fix it. These are the rules that you know, play safely. So that has to be factored in this so-called risk-benefit ratio to decide whether you choose or do not choose. And you put it all together. I want you to know, and this I tell you, the moment they're alone by now, instructed to their money. There has never been a case in which you didn't know what to do in the case. I've never been able to put a lecture together that gives you a list of regulations, rules, here I'll be behaving in space. That you can't do. Too many variables here. But there's never a case you don't know what to do. Every case has a solution. This case over here, the little woman I called last night about the father needing a bypass. Of course, there's no basis to do this surgery. What I told you, you shouldn't. Man had maybe diseases to live. 4 weeks back in the doctor said, I'm going to get into major abdominal surgery, resection of the bowel and the sugar. Irrelevant. You can't let him have a lie like that. You can't do it. Not if you ever saw a patient with structure. You never saw occupation, the structure you can talk to nice and easy, no doubt. No risk benefit. There's not a little bit. Don't lose it. So what do you do over to this patient? And the patient's bleeding to die because he can't live this way. So you take the risk. Not because I want to live a little bit longer. But not having died this way. I'd rather have him die on the table. That's the truth. I say that. I don't want to kill him. But the risk of dying isn't so terrible as the risk of living. And that comes into the patient. Next case, a good comment of mine, Maurice Schwartz of Albany. Nearby in Albany, there's a question of Bond here. This is a chap in the hospital. It's a beautiful case. That case
person that didn't want to put the patient on a respirator. The patient is trying to be in our order. The patient's not going to live. No sense of putting on a respirator, etc. So the patient's struggling to breathe. And I called the medic and he told the doctor he had to put the patient on a respirator. No way. Patient on a respirator who lives for months and months without sleep. Nothing so terrible at all. Whatever problem is bothering her, I don't know, but certainly it's the right thing to do. The patient wants to die? No. The patient asked. When she felt she was slipping away, she told the doctor, I want you everything complete to live. If I can go on a respirator to put me on a respirator, I do not want to die. Patient says, what's the stuff in your mind? The patient becomes incompetent, stands up, doctor decides, not going to put on a respirator. So they go ahead. Remember, you get the family sign of DNR order. Calls me up, I say, it's wrong. Tell the family to unsign the order, tell me they can't do it. They can do it instantly. Pardon? No. Daughter calls me up. No, they're supposed to, they can't see the mother struggling, so I said, it strikes me there's some problem here. The patient was fine before. She wants to live. Something happened. I don't see that. The patient is dying. Dying is cancer patient. And I, in whatever length of time, started going to give them. But not now. It doesn't seem like it. No. They'll go for more years. All is silent. The doctor convinced the patient's family, they shouldn't remove the video in our order. Go ahead and let the patient die. And suddenly, he came into visit in the hospital. Patient's all better. Patient's breathing fine, their own whatever condition was come up, resolved itself, etc. Oh, how smart our hospital was. I said, this is the doctor, don't understand it, how it could be, etc. So, how often did he take the judgment, medical judgment, and say, I think you're right, and the doctors are wrong? How often did he say, this patient is not dying in the old definition of a dying patient? Patients who can live. They could do what you want. I, the patient, cannot bear living on a respirator for a while. That's the patient's patient. He asked the patient, no, I want it. She didn't say it when the patient was already needing the respirator, but 2 days earlier she said, so by any rule, secular and religious, you should have treated this patient properly. Both of them worked out. But the patient didn't listen to the doctors and didn't die. The patient decided to live. The patient will die. Both the most telling cases are, and I've been involved only twice in such a case, both in Lowry Garden, in which a former party doctor who refused to treat the patient, saying the patient shouldn't do anything to the patient, etc., and the patient attended the doctor's funeral. So that way too. Okay. What I want to do now is have you start focusing attention on our next topic, and I didn't get a chance to do much with you yet in putting together a material reading material. I have a nice file which I will be sharing with you. We'll do first this triage section with number 7. We'll just do that first, simply where I develop the lectures. This term seems to fit better. And I normally develop the true human experimentation and transplantation. We'll do triage and then the transplantation. It's likely to, there isn't much in this textbook on it, but implied in it, you have many, many cases there that you can see the triage concerns there. I have to do is, before we go to the case I assigned to you in this subdivision, I'd like to call your attention to this essay that I handed out at 90, the Zombie Shop. This speaks a little bit to that first handout I gave you, in the call by this fellow Alvin Feinstein, complaining about the medical profession not letting his mother die, and we reanalyzed it. The medical profession, instead of it, he said, he reached his medical profession,
We should be overjoyed in a history of a woman that was properly treated. And that means treatment, although she has lost some of her previous independence, etc., lived a life which must be identified as an adequate quality for people. And he who has something that directs itself to the quality of life is another aspect. And it's a problem that is one that has literally no solution. Let me focus on the problem for you a little differently. It belongs to the ethics of the end of life, not dealing with a dying patient in the sense of a medically acute condition, but the fact that Kavin Bolton says, the nation of sin and man is Shin Shana, and the rule of Shon Shana, that at past age 80, there is a dying process. The growth curve converts to a death curve. That's been seen, that's a fact. And those who give as many years as you're entitled to, and no one's going to knock the years between 80 and 90, people live constructive lives. My father-in-law is 91 and he died over the last 2 years. In 2 years, he was as productive as he ever was in his life. That's when some growth is good to you. But most people fall into the purview of this effort. And here, let me explain the problem is. The largest number of people, I'll put it differently, the most, I think, now, of age of patients in old age homes is now 90. The largest number of patients in old age homes are in their 90s. That is, of course, a great compliment to the medical care that we get in America. As we have people, large numbers of people who enter their 90s. A large number of these large number of people do not have the family support that enables them to live at home. You have the rare individual, well, that's from 92 or 93, is jogging 8 miles a day. Not too many. Most people are complaining to doctors. This knee hurts, that elbow hurts, arthritis. And a large number of them are in need of outside help. A large number of them are financially able to buy permanent help. And the only way to do that is by entering into some kind of arrangement with a geriatric center. That way, by taking out a kind of a policy with them, they pay a certain amount of money, a regular monthly rate, and they know that they're taken care of. Those who have no family, as long as they have to see, have no family, of course. Then there are people who have family. And one of the sad circumstances today is from both sides. Children who cannot care for parents, they just cannot. I mean, they will not, but really can't. Emotionally, psychologically, can't, although physically, no reason why not. Well, Hashem, they're earning a lot of money. The father put them to medical school, to law school, and they're doing very well. They build the 5 rooms on the side of the house, and build the whole school for their parents, no problem. They can't cope with it psychologically. Why? You know. I saw an unbelievable comment Yaakov comes to see Yosef in the Friday. On Musa Afan, Acha and Ozi, the Fanel. Musa Afan, he says, so now you have to see me. All along, I said you. A father having to be fed by a son is dead itself. It's a true. Now, I could not die a happy man, it would be a perfect person. I could die a happy man, now that I see him. No. If a Musa found not the person, he never did the same. That's a fact, though. And therefore, because of that, many parents prefer to go to retirement villages, etc., etc., not to be a burden on the children.
That's an attitude of a father here. And the brethren and the father of the children, you have that problem. But don't go. And that's all about his problem this week. Which are an unbelievable letter was sent to a mother of the Redeemer last night. It said, "You come to our home today, sir. Please bring along with you leisure activities for me, because I have no time to spend with you." Told him this woman, both of her, said, "How much time do you spend with your mother?" "Oh, she hasn't been in the house for 4 years. Well, take this paper, we invite her to come to the house." "So how long will she be?" "Just for the story." "I feel about the whole week." "Is she right?" "To her mother." "Remember, I have a time for you. Then come and eat. Please go. I have a time for you. Come to eat. But bring along my puzzles to play with. Or you can play with coloring books. Take along leisure time activities so that you will not be lonely." That's also a kind of a psychology that is developed on the other side. "I have no obligation to my parents because they are out of my social groups. And therefore, I can't reach into their social groups. They can enjoy my social groups." Although no one can say, why not? Most parents can join any social group they want. That's the reality. Milford has developed a whole system of geriatric care that ranges from the fabulous to be absolutely abominable. And if you go to quote a good old age home, the monkeys, for example, we have a good old age home. He's a good one. God forbid you should get caught in that. That's one of the best. Okay? It's a horror house. What do you do? So what develops is bring a pharmacological geriatric center. It's no indication. Then you have people who are being medicated. No different than in Russia, when you put it someone that's sending you into an internet virus, it's a death sentence. And it's drugs for 5 years, blow the brain, etc. That's essentially what has been happening. Not only in geriatric centers, but in psychiatric centers. What do you do when you have 50 patients and 2 attendants? Well, the only way you can care for them physically. Find them where they have to chase them down the hallway. Make sure they stay in a room to each other. They're lying there and sleeping. You go down for weeks and eat the children. Rather than have to worry about sobering and so on. You give them another pill and they light it through and that's all. And essentially, what this essay does is call your attention to the fact that when you're talking about informed consent, and you talk about risk-benefit ratios, and you talk about care of the elderly, care of the dying patient, you realize that we violate all these rules in care of the elderly patient, who's not a sick dying patient. But we provide them with so-called physical care, and then treat them in a way that violates all the rules of autonomy that we've been discussing today. There's no informed consent to taking the drug. The involuntary administration of medication is a clear violation of all ethical principles, the most likely legal principles as well. And if you send it to irrational conclusions that we have in America today, and there's case after case in the court, that a sick patient, mentally ill patient, can also refuse to take drugs, refuse to take medication. Just as a sick patient refused to have an X-pillow, a sick patient refused to swallow a pill too. And you can't force them to take the pill. And then you have women like a woman, whatever her name was, every now and then they change the name on her. So the city ruled that murder civil rules and drew that she was being incarcerated against the will, this black woman. So we let her out. She was 50 out of the street, one of the homeless so-called, and they drowned in one of them, she had to run on the several names,
Yeah. And she made the front pages of the New York Times and TV programs interviewing her, etc. And now where is she now? Standing in the 42nd in some place, cursing at the car as they go by. Had some phase of what seemed to be just aberrant behavior, and now seeing psychotic behavior. Done racing for her because the rules that you're violating her autonomy by taking her into a that yes, worse than treating her for whatever psychosis she has. But we don't question that an elderly patient who is not psychotic, there's nothing wrong with him, can be given drugs, quote, to tranquilize, to quiet such a patient. This will develop a little further. Let me deal with the unit on the control of behavior, unit number 5. But I thought I'd introduce it over here at the end of our discussion of care of the elderly, or care of the ethical issues at the end of life. Let me now just introduce the unit that will begin next week on triage. Give a little introduction to it, and we have to discuss that case. You all read that case I gave you, the geriatric case. Okay, you recall which one it was? Edgar Jones case. Okay? Let me take off on that case. You read it? You got an introduction. What would you do in that case? Because you remember what the case all about, and the patient got into trouble on the surgical table, and the patient putting on a respirator, and not putting a respirator, and they put on a respirator, and now they also have to walk the respirator. Let me complicate that case a little before you by telling you that you just had a car accident, and then the drone was on a respirator, and then dragged in an 18-year-old who was running through the windshield. Suffered some serious brain damage. Liver surgeons haven't been called in there to evaluate what can be done. But the patient is not breathing well and doesn't need a respirator. That would be bleeding into the brain, especially around the breathing sensors, and get into the real trouble in a few minutes. So the neurosurgeon won't have to make any decision when he comes unless I can keep him breathing. One respirator, and the drone has it. Or 10 respirators, all of which are doing pretty good work. The patient is most likely to need any better. And Edgar Jones is one of the patients who has a respirator, and the doctor feels that Edgar Jones is very new. Will you remove the respirator from Edgar Jones? That's the kind of triage question that you have, that is doubly complicated. It's complicated because you're choosing between two patients, but doubly complicated because you're removing treatment from one patient, not just initiating treatment on one rather than the other. It's different than schlepping in two people off the highway and both need respirators and have one respirator standing there. Who should be put on a respirator? That's one kind of question. The second kind of question involves a far greater ethical insult to the one who will not get the respirator. It's not enough to give it to him, but you take it away from him. Okay? This is what's known as, or should be known, and it's a better term than triage, as life for death. That was the original term that was used, and now term made it in the field. If you go into any hospital and you enter the admission section, you'll see there's a sign there, triage death. That's usually a nurse there who decides how sick you are, her estimate, how quickly you have to be ushered in to see a physician. Instead of coming in at a sprained ankle, say, well, I come in, I believe so good. I move a little faster. This starts coming in and bleeding, and
Trouble sponsoring the flow of blood.
This is bad rules. Who comes first?
That's Tiyan.
The 10 Tiyans are calling all our kingdom. Right?
The great land battle of the First World War, where they divided up the wounded into three sections, three units, right? Three large.
Right?
One unit
that you would kill them on
first.
No sense in making a limited medical wound that you had on them. They're not going to make it anyway. Master wound, they're going to throw and be shot, so there's no way out in the field to help them anyway. No sense in wasting time anyway.
The group in which you think here gets the shot, you know, they can hold out another day too, and therefore you can afford to neglect them because they only have 2-3 medics. They can handle all the wounded. And the middle group is the one where, in my estimate, I can get the greatest bang for the buck, right? The greatest utilization of my medical facility by finding the intensive triage concept. So triage concept introduces already the first ethical rule that is almost, I think, consensus of most people in the field, including the halakha. And that is that medical suitability based upon medical considerations, that my treatment will work best if I give it to this individual. Now that's a major ethical decision to make. Because if you're going to follow the classic definition of the infinite worth of life and a little piece of infinity and tenderness, how can you tell me that because this fellow it will work well, I'll cure him. This fellow won't work well, I won't cure him. I'll keep him alive a little bit longer. Who says that keeping this one alive a little bit longer isn't as helpful as curing this fellow? Well, the answer is no, it isn't. That's the thing. The one who will help best is the designated of this individual, because he has a illness that I have a medicine that's suitable for it. So the medical suitability consideration refocuses my resource on his needs. But my resource and his needs have a connection due to the medical suitability of his condition. What about social utility or contribution to society? Here you have an intriguing thing. I'm going to do it to you. I'll do it for the case. I wrote a letter defending the Starville at the transplant unit in Pittsburgh, the most prestigious unit we have in America, and also pioneered a liver transplant and into everything their heart does, kidneys, etc. He was under severe attack. I mentioned the case, he was in attacking. Eight Iranians were given heart transplant and liver transplant. I mean, someone who blew the whistle and proved that they were put ahead on the priority list and bumped. Eight Americans who were waiting, they got the liver transplant. That led to my master's discussion in committee in Congress and the decision to pay for it, to launch and pay for a computer, a nationwide computer program that would make that impossible. Everybody would know who's on first, who's on second. That's the outcome of the question of blood. Very thoughtful fellow. No topic whatsoever that he did not benefit from this. Kind of a, so I'm on the table, paid him, I still got you out there.
When he defends himself, he defends himself. And then whether he defends by the characteristics or so, possibly confirming his approach, it says very simply, he's funding $8 million. $8 million, I'm saying, two more surgical teams. Because in addition to the shortage of organs, we'll talk about when that's a transplant team, there's a shortage of people to harvest organs. People think, no problem, the complication starts in when you stick the liver to somebody. Complication starts when you take the liver out of somebody. You get the liver in you. With a chicken liver, you get the liver out, you don't got a liver. You got to prepare that liver at the time of harvesting, as they call it, so that it can be used for transplant. And you skilled surgeons to jump into the proper jet and scoot down to a place to have so much time to do the work, get it back in time, and it's still to be useful. Well, don't have that many people to harvest. Many livers, many hearts go to waste because no one wants to take it. And you know there are far more recipients, people in need than there are donors. Yet you lose many of them, don't they? And that was 3 hours. I became a little team. I could buy more equipment. By bumping 8 people on the list, I will benefit thousands of people. My team didn't work for 5, 10, 15 years. That was his decision. When he said, the business is going to go that money. Money stolen from our dad, so it's going to go that money. No? Yes, it's fine, sir. Let me give you the moral solution to the problem. Who gets the liver?
More Abraham?
More Moses, not the two. Corin tells you the lady. Lady tells you the girl. Right? Tom McCock, I'm quoting my knowledge.
It's very simple.
The doctor, two times they eat liver. You call a brother Halaf and ask him, why did you get under the right? What have you recorded on your book? Correlating this individual. On that basis, you live here in the office. Often very right. What do you do that tomorrow? It's our tomorrow, man. That's not my reading tomorrow. It's Tommy Bobby, but it's not a reading. Okay, that's a good point to stop that. Okay, from here.
Just take a